Please be seated. Tonight's reading comes from Proverbs 31. It can be found on page 665 of the Bible that was on your seat. Page 665, Proverbs 31. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty, and remember their misery no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. An excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor, and reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet. She makes bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household, and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her of the fruits of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. We stand as we continue singing.
And if you're here with us for the first time, just to say there's an outline of the talk on one of your sheets, the white sheet, headed Making Life Work, the A to Z. And you'll find it helps keep the passage open, so that's page 665 in the Bibles. I'm going to begin with a prayer. Lord God, we've just sung of your love, which is vast as the ocean. We've sung of your grace shown to us in the Lord Jesus Christ. And we pray you'd help us now as we consider how we should rightly respond to that. We've just sung the words, "Let me seek your kingdom only, and my life to be your praise." And we thank you for the way that the book of Proverbs unpacks what that sort of life of praise should look like. And so we pray you'd guide our thinking in these few moments together, and that it would shape our living in the days ahead. Amen. In India today, there are 4 to 5 million sadhus living in caves and forests and temples. And the sadhus are the ultra-committed holy men of Hinduism. They are ascetics who have withdrawn from the business of ordinary life to devote themselves to a life of meditation. Through yoga, through meditation, through the contemplation of God, they hope to achieve liberation from the cycle of reincarnation. This idea that a life of contemplation and withdrawal is the ultimate is not limited to Hinduism. You see it in the Buddhist monks. You see it in the Christian church, in the 4th century desert fathers. in the medieval monastic tradition, and it has contemporary expression in the mystical tradition with its emphasis on meditation. You see this ideal not just in religion, but also in secular philosophy. The life of contemplation as the ideal, it goes back at least as far as the Greek philosopher Plato in the 4th century BC. In his book, The Republic, Plato argued that the best life of all is the life of philosophy, rational thinking, reasoning, a life of contemplation and leisure. What is the good life? What does the good life actually look like? Is the ultimate a life of withdrawal and contemplation of God? If we were truly committed, is that what we would all be doing with our lives? The book of Proverbs blows a huge raspberry at any such notion. In this book, God tells us what the good life looks like, and it is the very opposite of a life of withdrawal and a life of contemplation. It is a life of engagement, a life of involvement, a life of practical godliness, in which we walk on the path of wisdom in the ordinary activities of our daily lives. This practical nature of true wisdom is there on pretty much every page of Proverbs, but it is epitomized in this final chapter of the book and in these two characters that we meet in Proverbs 31, a man and a woman, a king and a housewife. Very different life situations, but the same emphasis on practical godliness. Or to borrow the title of J.C. Ryle's book, Practical Religion. Proverbs 31 challenges us about the need to have an active faith, one that is lived out, one that makes a difference to our daily lives. Firstly then, in verses 1 to 9, we have a rebuke to an imperfect king. Verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? All we know about King Lemuel is what we have in these 9 verses. That's it. This is all he's left to posterity. And what a legacy. A stinging rebuke. What is recorded here is the telling off that he got from his mum. He may have been king, but that didn't stop his mum giving him a right wigging. What are you playing at? His mum is saying in verse 2. He gets a right royal telling off, as the tabloids would have had the headline. But why? What has he done? Well, firstly, he has a problem with sex. Verse 3, do not give your strength to women, to your ways to those who destroy kings. Now, this isn't saying that women are evil and destructive and he should keep well clear of them. 18 verse 22 says that he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favour from the Lord. But on King Lem's radar, there wasn't a wife, but women. It may well be that he was a womanizer, someone who used his position and his power to get what he wanted and to satisfy his sexual passions. His sexual immorality was sapping his moral strength, and it would be his downfall if he didn't change. And he wouldn't be the first king to have fallen in that way. And secondly, he's got a problem with drink. Verse 4, it's not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink. As king, he would have had access to as much drink as he wanted, and it seemed he was making the most of that. This guy had an alcohol problem. Why was it serious? Well, it was serious because it was affecting his judgment. It's not for kings, verse 5, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. You see, people who came to this king were being denied justice. He wasn't doing his job rightly because he was drinking, and this drink was clouding his judgment. And that's one of the problems with drink, isn't it? That under its influence, we end up doing things which are wrong and we end up neglecting what is right. In verses 6 and 7, he's told that the poor in his land, they're in such misery because of his bad rule, they could well do with some of his drink to drown their sorrows. Instead of opening his mouth to pour in more wine, he should have been opening his mouth to speak out for the poor and the oppressed in the land. Verse 8, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. What was the good life for King Lemuel? Well, not to withdraw into contemplation of the divine, but to sort out his problem with women and wine, and to start being a ruler of integrity. What will it look like for you? What will it mean for you? The warning to King Lemuel is particularly applicable to those in positions of leadership and responsibility, whether in the workplace or in the home or in the local church. Beware sex and drink, lest they prove to be your downfall and the downfall of those who depend on you. Are you in a position of responsibility at work, or at home as a parent, or in the local church as a small group leader, or heading up a serving team? Beware the danger of flirting, of pornography as an escape from the pressures, of a position of trust leading to unfaithfulness, of maybe thinking that power entitles you to do what you want. Beware the danger of using drink as a way of coping with the stress and the pressures. But this warning applies equally to all of us as well, whether or not we're leaders as such. We may not all be leaders, but all of us were actually created by God to be rulers. Remember in Genesis 1:26, the God-given mandate to human beings was to rule over the creation. But one consequence of our rebellion against God is that instead of ruling, we are ruled. Instead of ruling, we are ruled over by sinful passions. We're mastered by our wrong desires. But if we're Christian, such passions should no longer be ruling over us. Part of God restoring his image in us as his people is that we become again the rulers that we were created to be. So is this restored rule reflected in your life? Or are you being ruled over by sinful passions? If King Lemuel's mum, if you knew what was going on in your life at the moment, in the area of sex, in the area of drink, would she take you on one side and would she say, "What are you doing?" Well, how do you behave in the office, in the staff room, on the business trip, on the work night out, alone behind closed doors? If sex or drink, if it is a particular problem for you, a problem area for you, if it's become an addiction in your life, an obsession, whatever you do, don't go into denial. Don't ignore it. Don't just hope it's going to go away. Do seek help. Do tell a friend. And if need be, get some expert help in working through it. This right royal telling off, it's actually quite a sad statement, isn't it? At the end of Proverbs, yet another ruler who messes up. King Solomon, whose book this was, I mean, he was no better, was he? In the end, sex was his downfall. It's easy to get disillusioned, isn't it, with those in leadership, as one after another of those who you look up to fall, whether in politics or in church life. With the elections in Zimbabwe this weekend, how much the people of that country must long for a righteous ruler. But in a sense, of course, we all do, don't we? We all do. And with every fresh scandal that hits the headlines, we long for a world ruled by a perfect leader. And so this right royal wigging of King Lemuel, it actually points us to Jesus, doesn't it? It points us to the perfect king. It should make us want to freely and joyfully submit to his rule. And it should make us long for the day when King Jesus will return and we will enjoy life in his perfect world under his perfect rule forever. So next time you read in the papers about yet another corrupt ruler, yet another compromised leader, instead of letting it get you down, we should let it lift our sights to Jesus and to the blessing of his perfect rule. Flawed King Lemuel. But this flawed king is not the last word in Proverbs. In the rest of the chapter, we're presented with perfection, the woman of verses 10 to 31, who is the very embodiment of wisdom. You'll see if you're on page 665 and you've got good eyesight, you'll see from the footnote 6 at the bottom of the page that these verses are an acrostic poem. And that means that each verse of this poem begins with the successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And that makes the poem more memorable, assuming you're reading it and learning it in Hebrew. And it also conveys the idea that this woman covers all the bases. So just as an A to Z of London, it contains every street that there is in London, so this woman is an A to Z of wise living in practice. Verses 10 and 12, 10 to 12 introduce us to this woman. Verses 13 through to 27 catalogue her deeds. And then verses 28 to 31 at the end are an invitation to us to join in praise of her. Well, what did wise living look like in this woman's situation? The description here is of tireless activity on behalf of her household. So her life involved purchasing, buying provisions for the household. Verse 13 says that she seeks wool and flax. She's like a merchant ship sailing off and coming back laden with provisions. Verse 16 says she buys a field, she plants a vineyard. Her life also involved production. So verse 15, she's providing food for her household. In verse 19, we find her at the spinning wheel making things. Verse 22, she's making bed coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Verse 27 over the page says she looks well to the ways of her household, and she does not eat the bread of idleness. Her life also involved selling. Verse 24 says that she makes linen garments and she sells them. She delivers sashes to the merchants. Her life also involved long hours, labouring day and night. Verse 15 says she rises while it's yet night. Verse 18, her lamp does not go out at night. Her life also involved not just providing for her own household, but also for the poor and needy. So verse 20 says she opens her hands to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. Her life involved also being wise in what she says and teaching her children. So over in verse 26, it says she opens her mouth with wisdom and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. Tireless activity. And what is the root of it? What is the root and the source of all this activity? Well, verse 30 over the page, a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. A woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. All of these labours are the practical expression of her fear of the Lord. Now, how are we to relate to this sort of description? Will wise living, will it look exactly the same for women today as it did for this woman back then? Should we conclude from this that the only legitimate sphere for godly women is the home? What does this have to say to men? Well, I've just put down some general principles that I think we can draw from this specific situation. Firstly, the wise life, for both men and women, the wise life is expressed in practical godliness. This woman's situation, her life situation, was clearly quite different to that of King Lemuel, but the message is basically the same. Namely, what God requires is that we fear him and that we live out the fear of the Lord in the ordinary practical business of our daily lives. So the ultimate is not to withdraw into some life of contemplation, but to get on with being a woman, a man of God, in your present life situation. For the king that meant sorting out his problems with wine and women and starting to rule with integrity. And for this woman, it meant running her household with hard work and dedication to provide for the needs of her husband and children and the poor around her. So the life of wisdom to which God calls us, it's not one of sitting around having nice thoughts, whether about God or about other people. It is a hands-on affair. In fact, a couple of verses in the poem crystallise this point, that it's a hands-on affair. The poem is in two halves which correspond to the two halves of the Hebrew alphabet. And the first half ends with verses 19 and 20. And as I read these two verses, look out for the hands. Verse 19 says, "She puts her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hands to the poor and she reaches out her hands to the needy." You see, her wise living is a hands-on affair. And that is something that the book of Proverbs is keen to impress upon us. The fear of the Lord, which is the very beginning of wisdom, needs to be expressed in a very hands-on way in our lives. We need to be getting our hands dirty, if you like, with practical godliness. The letter of James in the New Testament is also wisdom literature, and we find the very same emphasis there, don't we? Namely, that faith, if it is genuine, will be seen in action, and very practical down-to-earth action in our lives. The second principle I put down there is that the godly housewife is heroic in God's sight. Now, this is probably slightly more controversial, and to avoid misunderstanding, I want to just clarify terms. By housewife, when I use this term housewife here, I'm using it according to the dictionary definition, which is a woman managing her household. A woman managing a household. When we hear the term housewife, we need to get rid of any stereotype picture in our minds of the 1950s American woman of leisure and luxury who hardly gets her hands dirty and has very little to do, it seems, apart from her nails and drink tea with the ladies. The Proverbs 31 woman is certainly not that, is she? Just reading through that description. For her, running a household, it meant hard graft night and day to provide for the material, the emotional, and the spiritual needs of her family. Such a godly housewife is heroic in God's sight. You see, verse 10 begins, an excellent wife who can find. Excellent, it's not a great translation. That word excellent. The word is actually translated elsewhere in the Bible as mighty or valiant. For example, it's used to describe male warriors in phrases such as mighty man of valor or mighty men of war. Now, you can understand why the translators here of the ESV didn't go for mighty woman, as it doesn't sound quite right, does it? And it sort of conjures up an image in your mind, maybe, of a female shot putter from the former German Democratic Republic. But the point is that the imagery in this poem is heroic. It is heroic imagery. Let me just give you a few more examples. The word translated gain in verse 11, that is the word for spoil from a battle. This picture of a warrior is reinforced by references to this woman's strength in verse 17 and verse 25. And she occupies a position of dignity. Verse 25 says, strength and dignity are her clothing. You see, the point is that this industrious woman running her household is heroic. She is strong, she's active, she's capable, she's dignified. She is the female equivalent of the Old Testament male warrior, going into battle and returning a conquering hero. She is the equivalent of that. Now that is very different, isn't it, to how many people view working in the home. It's very different. In our society, many see the role of housewife as being beneath women. To run a household, to provide for your husband, to raise children, is regarded as demeaning. It's regarded as not making the most of your abilities. It's regarded as wasting your life and your talents when you could be climbing up the professional ladder. But this is saying, it seems to me, that in God's sight, the godly, hard-working housewife is a heroine. She is a champion. If we look down on such a role, we are letting our minds be shaped by the world rather than by the word. And if you are a housewife, or if your wife is a housewife, that is something to be proud of. It's not something to be embarrassed about. Now, obviously, being a housewife is not an option for all women. The single woman, the married woman without children, the married woman whose children have now grown up and left home. For some women, their circumstances will mean that they will need to go out to work because they don't have a family to raise. They don't have a household to run. And so the context in which they are to express practical godliness during the day may be the office or the classroom or the hospital ward. We also need to acknowledge that running a household in a modern Western culture like our own is not quite the same as it was back then. It's not quite as demanding as it was in that ancient biblical culture. So women today generally, that I know, don't have to grow their own food, and they don't have to make all their own clothes for the family and their own bed coverings and so on by hand. And so running a household in our culture may well be combined with what we call work outside the home. But when all that is said and done, I think the point still stands that what we need to beware is an attitude which dismisses the role of running a household as being petty, as being unrewarding, unfulfilling, unchallenging. It's very striking that to end this book about wise living, the model that God leaves with us to sum everything up, is not a warrior, it's not a ruler, but it's a housewife. Another principle there, final principle. Practical godliness is more important than physical beauty. Verse 30 says, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised." You see, in God's value system, fearing him and living wisely is of infinitely greater worth than charm and physical beauty. The Proverbs 31 woman is the true supermodel. Now, that isn't to say that physical beauty is a bad thing. I mean, the Bible acknowledges that some people are more physically beautiful than others. Certain women in the Bible are noted for their physical beauty. For example, Sarai, Rebecca, Rachel, Job's daughters. But this verse is telling us to put that sort of physical beauty in its proper perspective. What counts in God's sight is that a person fears the Lord and is living that out in practical godliness. Not that they're good looking or that they're sexy. Now, as we close, I want us to think through some implications of these principles for us. Firstly, choose a marriage partner wisely. Proverbs is written in the first place as instruction for young men. We noted in the early chapters the recurring phrase, "my son, my son." Chapter 18, verse 22 encourages the finding of a wife. It says, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favour from the Lord." But this final poem urges making a wise choice. Make sure biblical criteria govern your choice. And that principle applies equally to single women as to single men. Don't be fooled by what somebody looks like. How sexy, how charming they are. Don't be fooled by that. That isn't what is most important, and that isn't what is going to last. Instead, the primary criteria must be twofold. Firstly, does this person fear the Lord? If not, forget it. The relationship is a non-starter if you are a Christian. And secondly, are they working out their fear of the Lord in practical godliness? And if not, keep looking. We need to beware making superficial judgments based on unbiblical criteria. Remember chapter 11, verse 22, which said this: "Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion." That's saying that if someone is beautiful and sexy, but not a godly Christian, we may think that they are a sort of Ming vase that's got a slight flaw in it. But in God's sight, they are a piggy wearing a piece of jewellery. So firstly, choose a marriage partner wisely. Secondly, if you are married, encourage your spouse in practical godliness. Verse 28 says of this woman that her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. So this husband praises his wife for the way that she is working out her fear of the Lord in practical godliness. Husband, do you do that? Are you doing that? How much do you praise your wife for her practical godliness? How much do you encourage her in that? Does your wife know, does she know that that is what you value her for above all else in her life? That she fears the Lord, that she's working that out in practical godliness. Or does your wife actually get the distinct impression that what really matters to you is her looks? It is her physical beauty. It is her figure. Is that all you ever praise her for? Is that what is most important to you? Because if so, you're not encouraging her in what matters most. And you are encouraging her to focus on things which won't last. On the radio the other day, it said that on average, women look in the mirror 74 times a day. How do they get these things? But anyway, that's what Lena told me. On average, women look in the mirror 74 times a day. And I imagine the men are not far behind. But that is a lot of looking in the mirror, isn't it? But is that not in part, perhaps, because women know that that is what most men are most bothered about? And if so, isn't that an indictment of us men? The letter of James describes the Bible as like a mirror. And perhaps women would be encouraged to spend more time looking in that mirror if they knew that godliness was what their husbands valued most in them. And if your wife is a housewife, do you praise her for the way that she is working out practical godliness in that context? Or do you just take it for granted? Or do you maybe make her feel that she's not doing anything of much importance? Are you maybe encouraging your wife to be a career woman because you want to be able to say to other people, my wife is a top whatever, and because her success in the world's eyes reflects well on you? Now, of course, similar points could be made, also applied to wives. Do you praise your husband for his practical godliness and encourage him in that? Is it clear to your husband that that means more to you than him being successful in his job and earning loads of money or not developing a pot belly and a double chin? Thirdly, whether you're married or single, get married, in inverted commas, to Lady Wisdom. Make sure you get hitched up to her in life. In chapter 9, if you were here for that sermon, we saw that there were two women in chapter 9 who weren't actual women, they weren't real women, but they were picturing, they were personifying the basic choice that we all have in life. The choice between folly and wisdom. And at one level, the woman in Proverbs 31 is not a real woman. On one level, she is Lady Wisdom making a final appearance. So, for example, in verse 10, it says, an excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. And the exact same terms are used in chapter 3 about wisdom, about Lady Wisdom. So 3:13 says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom. Verse 15, she is more precious than jewels. So on one level, the excellent wife of Proverbs 31 is a picture of wisdom. And it's a final invitation to embrace her in life and to be married to her, if you like. So whether you're married or single, the question is, are you united to wisdom? Are you cherishing wisdom in your life? Do you fear the Lord? Are you committed to expressing that reverence for the Lord in practical godliness? Is growth in practical godliness, is that our number one ambition? How much of our thinking time and our energy is devoted to our appearance as opposed to the cultivation of godly character and lifestyle? To becoming more like Christ, the one who perfectly embodies God's wisdom, the one in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And a final implication as we close, and that is, long for the world to come. You see, this poem in chapter 31 paints an idyllic picture, a perfect picture. This woman is flawless and her life is blessed without reservation. Verse 25 says she laughs at the time to come. But in the real world, of course, in the real world, the excellent woman of Proverbs 31 gets breast cancer. In the real world, she doesn't do everything right. That is the reality of life in a fallen world. And the Bible isn't naive about that. The reality of our fallenness is all too apparent in King Lemuel, as well as in the other wisdom books of Job and Ecclesiastes. But this final poem in Proverbs, it focuses for just a moment on the ideal, on what life could be like if we in the world were as God intended them to be, on what life will be like when we in the world are transformed in the age to come. This picture is, if you like, it's like a photo of a sunset. A photo of the sunset which seems like paradise. But the photographer has framed the shot in such a way as to leave out the dirty great building site, which is just off to the left of the frame of the photo. But one day, there will be no building site. It will be the perfect world. It will be this perfect world with which the book of Proverbs ends. And that should spur us on to keep fearing the Lord now and to keep living that out in lives of practical godliness. Well, let's pause to respond in prayer. We'll have a time of quiet to do that. And then after a minute or so, we'll stand and sing this song of recommitment. I will offer up my life in spirit and truth.